The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Volume 4, The Medieval World. Episode 71, The Mongols, Part 2. Let us summarise what we have learned from our most recent episodes about the Mongols, the Battle of Chengdu, and the lifetime of Chinggis Khan. In the 12th century, the tribes of the steppe were still ethnically and linguistically diverse, and continuing elements of the ages-old nomadic lifestyles which had become a thing of the past further south in more developed agricultural societies. There existed confederations of tribes due to the fact that the lands of the steppe were highly competitive, as hunting grounds would be contested over by neighbouring tribes. As a young man, Chinggis Khan had to win the popularity with people in order to be taken seriously. He formed some critical alliances in order to gain some leverage and climb the social ladder by gathering more and more followers. He would do this by canny diplomacy and selective aggression. Eventually, he would emerge as the most dominant ruler of the tribes of the steppe. After Chinggis Khan had united the tribes of the steppe, he set his sights on the more developed, wealthy, and established nations further south. It was an ambitious task, but Chinggis Khan's ingenuity and ability to come back stronger after defeats meant that he could have the edge over his opponents. Initially, Chinggis Khan led the Mongols to subjugate the Tanguts of Western Xia before terrorizing the Jurchens of northern China, called the Jin Dynasty. The Jin may never have imagined that their established nation of northern China could be seriously threatened by the Mongols. But it very much was, and Chinggis Khan incredibly took control of the Jin capital city of Chengdu, which we know today as Beijing. Chinggis Khan did not press on in Jin China. Instead, he left a Mongol contingent in China while he turned his attention west and to the state of Karakitai, where a troublesome Naiman tribal leader had taken control of the Karakitai nation and begun attacking cities under the protection of the Mongols. Chinggis Khan successfully attacked and conquered Karakitai, and this would represent a valuable gateway to the great nations of the west, as he now controlled the Asian leg of the Silk Road between China and Persia. When Chinggis Khan attempted to open trade links and relations with the Khwarazmians, who controlled the lands around Persia, the reception that they received was very hostile. So Chinggis Khan raised an army with the intention of invading the far-off lands of Khwarezm. This was an incredibly ambitious project, but Chinggis Khan was the all-round leader. He seemingly thought of absolutely everything and prepared fully before committing to the invasion. It wasn't just militarily, but gathering intelligence and ensuring that his supplies were adequate and replenishable. The war between the Mongols and the Khwarezmians is considered to be one of the most deadly in history, but amazingly the Mongols defeated and destroyed Khwarezm by the year 1221. Chinggis Khan himself went back to the east to deal with rebellion within the Tangut state of Western Xia, who were making new alliances with Jin China. Chinggis Khan would lead his army into Western Xia, where they would besiege the major cities, but to great effect, using all of their combined knowledge and experience to gain success. Chinggis Khan did not live to see the day when Western Xia fell, but by 1227, Western Xia had indeed done so. Now, let's find out what happened to Chinggis Khan's vast empire now that he had passed away.
After Chinggis.
Most great rulers will have a plan for their possessions and their kingdom or empire for after they die. Chinggis Khan was no different. Before Chinggis Khan invaded Khwarezm, the question was raised about who should be his rightful successor. The eldest son, Jochi, wanted the honour, but the second son, Chardai, strongly objected. It was always strongly suggested that Jochi was not actually Chinggis Khan's real son, with his mother Borte suggested to have been impregnated while being a captive of the Merkit tribes. Chinggis Khan certainly did bring Jochi up as his own son regardless, but Chardai deemed him to be a bastard and unworthy of this honour as a consequence. Chinggis Khan knew that his imperial reach was vast and told his sons that they would each have plenty of lands to govern and that the healthiest solution would be to have the third son, Ugude, as the future great Khan, and it was tentatively but cordially agreed by everybody. The Jochi problem did not exist at the death of Chinggis Khan, for Jochi had actually died before Chinggis Khan. The circumstances around Jochi's death are hazy, but there is a suggestion that he might have been poisoned. Either way, he was not alive after Chinggis Khan's death. The homelands were allocated to Chinggis Khan's youngest son by his main wife Borte, namely Tulwe. Tulwe would govern these lands, but the intended successor as Great Khan would still be the third son, Ugude. The second son, Chardai, ruled over the lands of Central Asia. It wouldn't be until 1229 before Ugude was officially recognised as the Great Khan. But despite the seemingly unenthusiastic manner in which he agreed to take the title some 10 years earlier, before the invasion of Khwarezm, Ugude would go on to show a lot of positive agency in the role. Ugude would turn his attention towards Jin China, which had been weakened considerably by the Mongols during the early 1210s. Jin China controlled the northern half of China and its ruling dynasty was descended from the Jurchen tribes. The Mongols had successfully run them out of their own capital city of Chengdu, modern Beijing, in the year 1214. While the Mongols had been somewhat distracted by affairs in the West, the Jin had joined in with the stirrings that had surfaced in Western Xia. After the Mongols had crushed Western Xia in 1227, Ugude decided that Jin China now needed to be comprehensively punished for their disobedience. Ugude would attempt to utilise the same style of tactics that his father had done, by splitting his army into multiple units in order to widen their impact. The Jurchens had pushed the Song dynasty of China out of their lands in northern China, down into the far south, and the Song had never forgiven them for it. The Song were only too happy to help the Mongols in their invasion of Jin China and forces led by Ugude's younger brother Tulue were allowed to travel through Song lands in order to invade Jin China from the south. If the Jurchens believed that the death of Chinggis Khan would expose frailties from within the Mongol Empire, then they would be mistaken. When the Jurchens fled Zhongdu in 1214, they established a new capital city at Kaifeng. It would not take long for the Mongols during the second invasion to besiege this new capital. Chinese societies and dynasties were mastering the use of gunpowder, and the Jurchens of Jin China used cannon fire and the thunder crash bomb to defend themselves. Gunpowder warfare in general was still in its early stages, and this thunder crash bomb was one of the earliest forms of bomb, with the gunpowder being held within a cast iron shell. The Mongols were also using gunpowder bombs, but the Jurchens' thunder crash bomb was something considerable. It has also been called the heaven-shaking thunder bomb, and when launched at the enemy with a lit fuse, on explosion it was described as being able to completely incinerate multiple men. The power of such weapons was not nearly enough to prevent the Mongols from crushing the Jurchens though. By 1234, Kaifeng had fallen and this was the beginning of the end. Song Chinese troops supported the campaign from the south, but the youngest of the three brothers, sons of Chinggis Khan by his primary wife Borti, who we know as Tulue, would not see the fall of Kaifeng. Like his older brother before him, Tulue's death was mysterious, and there were rumours of him being poisoned, but other accounts of his death coming simply as a result of alcoholism. With the situation in Kaifeng becoming too bleak, the Jin Emperor fled and committed suicide, leaving the Mongols to take control. The Song were under the impression that the Mongols would reinstate them in their original lands and moved in on Kaifeng after the Mongols sat back, and this would instigate ill feeling between the Song and the Mongols going forward. As we know, the Mongol Empire was now a vast expanse of lands, so there were many other fronts that needed to be considered. With the intended division of land suggesting that Jochi should take control of the Mongols' lands in the northwest reaches of the empire, the fact that Jochi had died before he could claim his prize meant that the lands would be inherited by Jochi's son called Batu. The lands would still come under the umbrella of Ugude Khan, Batu's uncle, but essentially it would be down to the young adult Batu to govern them. These lands had been traditionally occupied by the Turkic tribes, including the Cumans and the Kipchaks. Batu's lands would be known as the Kipchak Khanate as a consequence, but the Rus principalities would refer to them by a name that has become known to us as the Golden Horde. One of the great Mongol military generals was a man called Subadai, and he had served Chinggis Khan well. He took over the responsibility of leading Tuluay's men after Tuluay's death during the invasion of Jin China, but as soon as he had completed that responsibility, he headed west to assist Batu in the westward expansionist ambitions of the Golden Horde. Batu Khan was not heading west without any intelligence. After the Mongols had crushed the Khwarezmian Empire over 10 years previous, Subadai had played an important role in defeating the Kingdom of Georgia before moving on to lands of the Kievan Rus, a once mighty empire that had since disintegrated into a bunch of independent principalities. The resulting Battle of the Khalkha River in 1223 served to debilitate the Rus principalities. 14 years later, Subadai was back, serving under the eager Batu Khan. The strategy was unsurprising. After waiting for the rivers to freeze so that the cavalry could cross, Batu Khan would attack city after city, with the ultimate aim being to reach the key city of Kiev. When Batu sent envoys ahead to Kiev to negotiate the city's surrender, the envoys were killed. Batu would now realise that total conquest was the only option now. Batu's father was Jochi, and one of Jochi's younger brothers was Tuluay. Jochi and Tuluay were now deceased, but a son of Tuluay, and therefore a cousin of Batu, called Monka, now joined the siege of Kiev. The weight of power behind the invasion was far too much for the city of Kiev, and it eventually collapsed, which led to the city being destroyed and the population being massacred. This would lead to the Rus principalities recognising the Mongols as their overlords, and the Mongols now having access to the nations of Eastern Europe. Silk Road trade routes now became more widespread and accessible, with the Mongols now controlling all of the Asian pathways. This was a significant moment in the history of global trade. Central Europe in the 1240s was dominated by Germanic nations. France dominated the western lands of continental Europe, while the middle of the continent was controlled by the Holy Roman Empire. The buffer between the Holy Roman Empire and the Rus principalities was at this time controlled by two nations, the Polish in the north and the Hungarians in the south. When Batu Khan took control of the Kipchak Khanate, some of the resident Cumans fled westwards to the Kingdom of Hungary. Batu Khan demanded that the Hungarians surrender the Cumans to the Mongols, and the Hungarians refused, giving Batu Khan an excuse to invade. With concerns about whether the Polish may choose to send reinforcements to Hungary to help protect them against the Mongols, Batu Khan would consider Poland to be a serious threat too, therefore he was prepared to go to war with both nations. The Mongol army was split up into smaller armies. One army was dispatched to Poland, where they defeated a combined European army at the Battle of Legnica in 1241. This prevented reinforcements from helping with the defence of Hungary when the Mongols invaded Hungarian territory just a couple of days later. The Mongols were too strong for Eastern Europe and began to close in on the much larger Holy Roman Empire and its allied territories. The conquest of Europe would not be easy for the Mongols, as European nations were united in their stand against the Mongols despite all of their differences with each other. We will never know exactly how far into Europe the Mongols could have penetrated during this drive into European territory in 1241, as a twist of fate changed the immediate future for everyone. The Great Khan, Ugudei, was known to be a heavy drinker, and in December of 1241, either a stroke or some kind of organ failure following a night of heavy drinking ended his life, and this triggered a succession crisis that required all key figures to head back thousands of miles eastwards to the Mongol capital city of Karakorum, a city built by Ögedei Khan himself. Initially, Ögedei's widow, Turgene, ruled the Mongol Empire as regent before their son, Güyük, was elected the new Khan. Güyük's reign did not last long. He had ambitions to revive the invasion of Europe after appointing local rulers in the Russian principalities now firmly under the rule of the Golden Horde. Güyük's ambitions in Europe were not played out as his untimely death changed the direction of Mongol politics yet again. Güyük's successor was his cousin and a son of Tuluwi called Mönkö. Mönkö's focus as the Great Khan was not in Europe but on other areas. The Mongols had already started making incursions on the Seljuk Sultanate of Rum during the 1230s and the 1240s. Mönkö would support further expansions in the Middle East as well as South China. During the 1250s, the Abbasid Caliphate existed in the city of Baghdad, but it was much more of a ceremonial presence than an imperial one. Its existence represented the descendant line of an uncle of the Prophet Muhammad and was therefore revered by the Islamic world. Even though the Mongol Empire exercised religious tolerance, they were totally indifferent to the sentimental value of the Abbasid Caliphate, an institution that had existed for over five centuries. The younger brother of Mönkö Khan was called Hulagu, and he was in charge of the Mongol push in the Middle East. The caliph in Baghdad was a man called Al-Mustasim, and he would not be ready to roll over to the Mongols when they did finally besiege the city in the year 1258. The city fell, and the caliph was executed. The population was massacred, and the Abbasid Caliphate was over. However, the following year saw the death of the great Khan Mönkö, and once again, Mongol expansionist ambitions were suspended. When the Mongols withdrew, the newly established Mamluk Sultanate, based in Egypt, pushed the Mongols away from Levantine lands and re-established the Abbasid Caliphate in Cairo in 1261.
Fragmentation.
The sons of Tuluwi, the fourth son of Chinggis Khan, were Mönkö, Kublai, Hulagu, and Ərikboka. They could collectively be called the Toluids. Mönkö became the Great Khan of the Mongols in the year 1251, but he died in 1259, leaving the throne vacant. Kublai would be a very natural candidate for successor, and he was very busy campaigning against Song China. Hulagu was also a contender. Not only was Hulagu very busy in the Middle East when his older brother died, but he was also thousands of miles from Mongolia. Another factor for Hulagu was the presence of one of his cousins called Berke. Berke was the son of Jochi, Chinggis Khan's eldest son, whose paternity was actually disputed. Berke was also the younger brother of Batu Khan, the man who had pushed westwards into Europe. When Batu Khan died in the mid-1250s, Berke inherited a degree of power, and now he was actually threatening the power of his cousin, Hulagu. Both Berke and Hulagu would be very wary of each other, and this made it very awkward for each of them to travel back to Mongolia. The other son of Tuluwi was Ərikboka. Ərikboka was actually in Mongolia, and in the absence of other contenders, he declared himself as the next Great Khan. Despite Kublai being a long way south from Mongolia, he would declare his opposition to Ərikboka and would have a good degree of support. Kublai himself was very much a Sinicized Mongol, based in the remnants of Jin China and familiar with all the modern technologies and traditions of Chinese culture. Arik Bocker was now based in the Mongol capital city of Karakorum, a great city created by his uncle, Ugude. Kublai travelled to Shangdu, a city that is also known as Xanadu, to declare himself as the anti-Khan. This rivalry for the throne sparked the beginning of the Tuluid civil war. The battles between the forces of Arik Bocker and Kublai were fierce and inconclusive, and the losses on both sides were considerable. It was Arik Bocker who could not sustain the losses to his resources, and he would have to flee westwards to the lands that had been originally granted to their uncle, Chadai. Resources were scarce in the west, with Arik Bocker now cut off from his supply lines, his allies defected, and he would have to give in to submission. So he humbly approached his older brother, looking for acceptance. Kublai took pity on his younger brother and spared his life. However, while under close guard, Arik Bocker mysteriously died, bringing to an end the Tuluid civil war. When Kublai's Kurultai was organised to recognise him as the Great Khan, none of the Khanates in the west bothered to come and recognise him. For all intents and purposes, the Khanates of the Mongol Empire were now operating independently. None more so than the forces under Berke and Hulagu, the two cousins and grandsons of Genghis Khan battling against each other in the west. As mentioned before, Berke was now in control of the lands formerly under his older brother Batu Khan and known to us as the Golden Horde. Hulagu, conqueror of the Abbasid Caliphate in Baghdad, controlled a large area of land centred on the former Khwarazmian lands in Iran, and known to us as the Ilkhanate. Both Berke and Hulagu were interested in the outcome of the Tuluid civil war, with Hulagu backing Kublai and Berke behind Arik Bocker. But the pressures of the politics of their lands in the west were taking a priority. The lands in the centre of the Mongol Empire were those under the control of the descendants of Chadai, and known to us as the Chadai Khanate as a consequence. In effect, the Golden Horde, the Ilkhanate and the Chadai Khanate had their political situations to deal with, and Kublai Khan himself was still much more interested in the affairs of China than the rest of the Mongols' imperial realms. This signalled the end of the Mongol Empire as a single cohesive unit, and although there were still alliances and a cultural connection between the Khanates operated independently and could just as easily be rivals than allies, depending on the political advantages and disadvantages. However, initially the Ilkhanate and the Mongol-controlled lands of China had a good relationship, and this meant that merchants could travel from west to east and back again in relative safety. It was under these conditions that the Venetian merchant Marco Polo was able to travel through Asia in the way in which he did, and we will focus on his travels in a future episode. As mentioned before, Kublai Khan was very much a man of Mongolic blood ruling over Chinese lands. In his bid to conquer the Song dynasty in the south, he would need the support of the Chinese population in the north, the lands that he already ruled over. Kublai would convert to Buddhism and declare his realm as the Yuan dynasty of China. He moved his capital from the Mongolian city of Shangdu to the Chinese city of Beijing, which would be named Dadu. Despite unrest back in Mongolia from those believing that Kublai was abandoning his heritage, Kublai had constructed a strong naval fleet to aid with the conquest of Song China, something that the Mongols had never really before had to consider seriously. Despite failures in his attempts to invade Japan, Kublai Khan did manage to defeat the Song after a lengthy pursuit. As the ruler of a united China, Kublai did employ the services of top Chinese officials, and he would tax his Mongol subjects less than his Chinese subjects in a bid to demonstrate loyalty to his roots. The expanse of the Mongol Khanates meant that there were cultural connections across the entirety of Asia that facilitated the spread of not just trade but also technology, one of the most notable being gunpowder. Cannons were being produced in France before the outbreak of the Hundred Years' War, so it is suggested that the knowledge spread from Mongols to Arabs and then from Arabs to Europeans. South and Southeast Asia were isolated from the rest of the world by Mongolic Khanates. Kublai Khan would defeat the Pagan Kingdom of Burma and subjugate the modern Russian island of Sakhalin, just north of Japan. But he couldn't make any lasting impact on the Vietnamese kingdoms of Dai Viet and Champa due to fierce resistance. So this marked the greatest extent of the Mongol Yuan dynasty of China. India, and particularly the Delhi Sultanate, would also face pressure from the Mongol Ilkhanate, but once again they met with great resistance and were unable to make any lasting impact on the Indian subcontinent.
Decline.
Crimea, a peninsula on the Black Sea, had been brought into the possession of the Golden Horde during the 13th century, and this was an important avenue for trade, with there being easy access to the Mediterranean Sea and many European ports to the west, and the traversable land route to China to the east. Two of the great competitors for European trade were the Venetians and the Genoese. It would be the Genoese who were able to strike up a deal with the Golden Horde to own a Crimean city, and they would call the city Kaffa, which we can recognise today as the modern city of Feodosia, which at the time of writing this episode is a Ukrainian city under the control of Russia. The ongoing relationship between the Genoese and the Golden Horde was very stressful. The Golden Horde considered Genoa to be using Kaffa with the Golden Horde's blessing, while the Genoese considered that they owned the city of Kaffa and the Golden Horde had no right to interfere with it. The tension escalated, with the Golden Horde attempting to limit the trade and resources to the city and the Genoese fighting back. This would result in the Golden Horde besieging the city from 1345. This siege may have ended up having repercussions for the entire Old World. It appears that the armies of the Golden Horde were suffering from a highly contagious illness that resulted in many deaths. The Golden Horde would then try to turn this to their advantage by catapulting the dead bodies over the city walls at Kaffa in a bid to infect the inhabitants. This has been described as one of the first instances of biological warfare known to history. The Genoese were able to resist the onslaught as the power of the siege dramatically weakened the army of the Golden Horde as a result of the great number of deaths. However, the Genoese travelled back to Genoa infected, and this is believed to be the cause of the Black Death spreading rapidly through Europe. In fact, the wider repercussions of the Black Death to the Mongols is also highly considerable. In 1335, the ruler of the Ilkhanate, Abu Sa'id Bahadur Khan, and his sons all died of a disease that may well have been the bubonic plague. This caused a weakening and fragmentation of the Ilkhanate. The effects on the economic prosperity of the Golden Horde were undoubtedly apparent due to the Black Death also, and would have surely been a contributing factor to the descent of the Golden Horde into civil war from the late 1350s. The Principality of Moscow, a development of a Rus principality that had fallen under the control of the Golden Horde in the 13th century, saw an opportunity to challenge that authority. Certainly the neighbouring Grand Duchy of Lithuania took advantage of the unrest and took some of its own territorial gains during this period. The Chadai Khanate also suffered during this period. Although we may suspect that the Black Death weakened the Khanate, the aggression of the Muslim rulers caused great unrest from within. Three of the four fragmented Khanates of the Mongol Empire had converted to Islam during their existence. The Golden Horde, the Ilkhanate and the Chadai Khanate were the three, while the Yuan dynasty of China swayed towards Buddhism. The tradition of descendants of Genghis Khan being the only people who should be able to become the Khans of the Mongol Khanates was now also under challenge, and one man who was not a descendant of Genghis Khan who had emerged from within the Chadai Khanate to become a notable ruler was called Timur, who has been also known to history as Tamerlane. Timur created a large empire in his lifetime which mopped up much of the lost lands of the Ilkhanate, and despite not being a descendant of Genghis Khan, he would claim to be attempting to restore Genghis Khan's empire to its former glory and therefore be acting in Genghis Khan's name. The Timurid Empire lasted until the 16th century. In late 14th century China, a rebellion broke out in the south which challenged the rule of the Yuan dynasty, which had been established by Kublai Khan in the previous century. Ultimately, this rebellion dethroned the Yuan dynasty and became the Ming dynasty. This effectively pushed the remnants of the great Mongol Khanates back towards the steppe grasslands by the end of the 14th century. Mongolic states existed in these areas for a few centuries, but with little in the way of political influence, and the lands in the south had developed and been taken by new peoples and dynasties by the 15th century, so the Mongolic peoples went back to a much more humble existence on the world map. The remnants of the Yuan dynasty had headed back north to Mongolia and were ultimately defeated by the Jurchen tribes in the 17th century, while the remnants of the Golden Horde and the fragments of the Chadai Khanate were swallowed by the eastward continental expansions of Russia. The legacy of the Mongols is quite profound on multiple levels. It is highly likely that the bubonic plague called the Black Death may have been contained within the sparsely populated lands of Central Asia, had it not been for the highly fluid movements of merchants and armies within the Mongol Empire, and this had a lasting impact on the entire known world. Regardless of this, the Mongols were innovative. Genghis Khan had a fresh, logical, and utterly ruthless approach to international relations. His diplomatic approaches and his military tactics were influenced by the societies he encountered, and went on to influence the societies that the Mongols went on to encounter.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, Leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of the History of the World podcast, rounding off our story of the Mongols. Now, in the next couple of episodes, we're going to be looking at some of the key battles of this period. So a couple more episodes revolving around this globalization of the Mongols. It's incredible, incredible expansion when you look at it and compare it to history and how on earth could this have happened? And this will be a big quiz for anyone looking at the Mongol history. It's an incredible achievement. You know, you'll all have made your own mind up what you think the reasons are for their success. And I'd love it if you emailed in, just email into us here at the podcast, historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. Let me know what you thought. If you enjoy the podcast and you'd like to support the podcast, then please visit our website, click on the Patreon link and sign up to make a monthly contribution. It really, really does help with the podcast. It helps me to invest in material that I can use to make the podcast that much more comprehensive. You will become a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati and you'll qualify for gifts and rewards. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, as I've already mentioned, you can drop me a line at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. But also, you can follow the podcast on Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Tumblr, Threads, and Mastodon. And if you can't get enough of the podcast, then do look out. There'll be another brief episode alongside this one, just a brief 10-minute episode for those of you who are hot welder junkies and can't get enough. You can listen to some of the background of this episode, some of the source material that I used. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how I structure episodes such as this. How do you go about writing such a monumental list of events in just a 30-minute episode? It was tough, but I'll tell you how I went about it in the debrief episode. So look for that. It comes out alongside this one, so you'll be able to listen to it almost straight away after you finish this one. Anyway, that's it for this week. Next week, it's the Battle of Legnica, when the Mongols met the Europeans. So that will be fascinating. We'll look at each of the different countries involved and some of the leaders and tell you all about them and then the defining moments of the battle and the legacy of the battle, as we usually do. But thanks very much for listening. And until next time, be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. See you next time.